The views and opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KUCI, its management, the UC Board of Regents, or nurses. Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the April 13th, 2021 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, in the first segment, we hear from Rusty Hicks, now running for re-election the next four-year term of the California Democratic Party chair. In the second segment, Brenda Lynn returns to talk about Irvine Watchdog's other enterprises. Let's start the show now with my first guest, Rusty Hicks, running for re-election to now a four-year term as the California Democratic Party chair, the election of which is now underway and closes on April 21st. These are delegates around the state that are voting in all of the state party positions. I'll summarize his career quite briefly. Prior to the chairmanship, Rusty Hicks was president of the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor, the California campaign director for Barack Obama in 2008, the presidential campaign. Rusty Hicks was a legislative aide to then California Assembly members Mike Gordon and Ted Lieu. He is a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy Reserves and is an Afghan war veteran. Rusty Hicks completed his bachelor's degree in political science from Austin College and is Juris Doctor at Loyola Law School. He comes to us today from his home in Pasadena. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Rusty Hicks.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. And as I said, with the one challenging you for this office, I have 10 more questions for every one question I'm going to get in here. So I just want to sort of roll the film back. A good deal has happened since your special election to the chair, the fall of 2019 convention in San Francisco. So at that point, it's like jumping on where the campaigns were already well underway. So it was quite a tall order to take on that. So now, what's your role as the California Democratic Party chair in what is going to become, I think it's going to clear for the statewide ballot, the California Governor Newsom recall? Does this draw away from resource and attention from 2022? Or Rusty Hicks, does this galvanize statewide party campaigns?
Well, I would say that certainly if we had our preference, we wouldn't have a Republican recall on the ballot. But as I've often said to many, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. And while some might see this as a crisis, you know, in some ways it can be viewed as an opportunity for us to continue to talk about the vision and values of what it means to be a Democrat in California, the opportunity to put in place the infrastructure, not only to beat back a Republican recall, but to get ready for some incredibly important races and campaigns in 2022. So, you know, if it qualifies, we'll be ready for it and to be successful in the fall.
So in the 2020 election, I often asked the grassroots involved in campaigning about, because a lot of people were forecasting, given certain outcomes in 2020, 2022 is going to be a real slog for Democrats holding legislative races, federal legislative races, among others. So I want to know, how do you as state Democratic Party chair build the kind of long game into your grassroots cadre? Because that long game is what keeps winning elections.
Well, I think we have to first remember that this idea that once you win a seat, you're entitled to hold it from now until the end of time. We don't own seats. We rent them every 2 years. And the races that we were successful in 2018 were hard fought. The races that we both won and came up short in 2020 were hard fought. And while we'll go through a redistricting process in 2021 and early 2022, I suspect that some seats will get easier and some seats will get harder, but they'll be hard fought in 2022. And so I think what we have to ensure that we are doing as a state party is that we are investing in grassroots leadership, grassroots organization, and really grassroots power that ultimately helps you win at the federal, state, and local levels, and helps you win over multiple election cycles. We began to do that. Obviously, we had great success on the congressional level in 2018. We begin to invest in a different way in 2020, and we're successful in a number of different spaces throughout the state. And we're continuing to invest in that infrastructure in preparation for not only 2022, but 24 and 2026.
So let's take then what had taken place in 2020. I'd like to ask you about lessons learned as we look at the outcomes in Orange County's congressional races. I'm mainly concerned about the 39th and the 48th and where the 45th is going to be going. But if we could first talk about what lessons were learned in the 39th and more expansive detail in the 48th, the Coastal Communities Congressional District.
Well, I think we, just broadly speaking, we have to recognize that there were some advantages in 2018 that were simply not available to us in 2020. In 2018, if you wanted to vote against Donald Trump, you voted for a Democratic member of Congress. If you wanted to vote against Donald Trump in 2020, you voted for Joe Biden, and then you decided amongst the two candidates that were before you on the congressional level. Two, the decision to place the safety of voters and volunteers alike over virtually all else had an impact. The result of not being in position to knock on doors and have one-on-one, face-to-face conversations with voters, not just in the 48th and the 39th, but in other places in the state, ultimately had an impact. And then lastly is that each one of those seats had its own unique challenges. In particular, in the AAPI community, for example, in the 39th, we saw a 5% increase in AAPI turnout. In fact, AAPI voters accounted for 35% of all new voters in the 39th.
Wow.
And in the 48th, Harley Ruda won the AAPI vote by 3,000 votes in those precincts where at least 25% of the electorate were AAPI voters. He won those precincts by 3,000 votes in 2018, but lost them by 3,000 votes in 2020. That's a 6,000 vote swing. That's approximately 75% of the overall loss. In that case, it's a different matchup with Harley Ruda running against Dana Rohrabacher versus Harley Ruda running against Michelle Steele in that district as currently configured. And so I think what it tells all of us is that we have to, one, be mindful of what is happening at the national level, what is happening in Washington, D.C., because it does have an impact in other parts, clearly has an impact in other parts of the country. Two, that direct one-to-one voter-to-organizer conversations do make a big impact in these tight races. And then three, there are specific constituencies, specific communities that we have to focus additional attention on, not just in the election season, but in many ways on a year-round basis, not just on around a particular vote, but also around important policies that impact and improve the lives of 40 million Californians.
So I'm aware there were a lot of resources that were put in, I'm leaping out of the 48th for a moment, but that in the 45th, there were a lot of resources getting students turned out with the movement politics rolling out from Memorial Day of last year, 2020, that there were, I think it was, it had a very energizing kind of feature aspect to it that more students realized, well, you don't get municipal leaders that piss you off. You don't get them to resign because you don't think because they piss you off. You need to elect them out. So there was that kind of movement energizing. And so I don't know if there is that, the 48th, the turnout just took for granted, I think, that there was a Democratic incumbent. I just, from my small anecdotal encounters, they were not energized. So what kind of resources do you have in energizing a public that got you past the 2018 that's still involved in a lot of movement identity politics that you need to support your incumbents and your Democrats challenging Republican incumbents in this round?
Well, I would say that, you know, the turnout in 2020 was anywhere from, in targeted races, was anywhere from 14 to as much as 16 points higher than where it was in 2018. I think the turnout mix was interesting, having, you know, the previous occupant in the White House liked to say that he was the greatest jobs creator that God ever created. And I don't think that's true. I think the numbers bear that out as not being true, but he was the greatest turnout machine that may have ever been created, and galvanized, you know, the electorate in a way in which we did not see from previous leaders at the federal level, particularly out of the White House. I do think 2022 has the potential to be unusual in the sense that typically the idea is that whoever is in charge of the White House takes significant losses in the House. You know, this idea that voters want to have a check and balance in their government. Well, that really relies upon the party that loses, in this case, the Republican Party, that lost overall, didn't pick up the House, lost the Senate, lost the White House. Typically, it relies upon a recalibration of that party to reset itself for the upcoming midterm. Well, you've not seen that. You frankly have seen a Republican Party double down on its embrace of Donald Trump. And while some, you know, Republican congressional members have tried to kind of walk the balance here in California, ultimately, I don't think they're going to be able to run away from the one individual to whom the Republican Party nationally, you know, pays homage to. And so, you know, I do think that while historically speaking, midterm elections have been tough for, you know, the party that is currently in the White House, I think there's an opportunity for us to be incredibly successful in 2022. The D trip out of, you know, Washington, D.C. is already, earlier this week, targeted the 48th, targeted the 39th, and of course the 25th congressional and the 21st congressional in North Los Angeles and the southern portions of the Central Valley. So those seats were, again, hard fought in 2018, hard fought in 2020, and they'll be hard fought again in 2022.
For those of you who've just joined us, my guest is California Democratic Party Chair Rusty Hicks, now running for re-election, the next term for the California Democratic Party Chair. We're recording this on April 9th. So the messaging, as you're talking about targets over the national campaign 2022, the messaging is already really clear what the GOP intends to do with restricting, suppressing essentially the voter turnout. And so I want to know if you could give us some insight that what is the message? What's the tight refrain that Democratic Party chairs in all states are doing to sort of counter that very disciplined approach to the message of the what is called the voting integrity message that the Republicans are using? What's the counter message from the Democratic Party from chair to chair, state to state?
Well, I would simply say that, you know, Republicans have, or in recent decades, have time and time again made it harder for Americans to exercise their constitutional right to vote. And in this case, they tried to claim fraud in their losing election. And then when they, now that they don't like the results, they're saying, we're going to try to change the rules. We're going to try to restrict some, not all, but some communities from being able to exercise their right to vote. Democrats have, especially here in California, have bent over backwards in making it easier to vote, making voting more accessible to now 22.5 million Californians who are voters. And so I think our message is pretty clear in that the Democratic Party, and in this case, the California Democratic Party, denounces the attempts by Republicans, both here in California and in other parts of the country, to deny the right of Americans to cast a ballot and have a voice in their democracy. We here in California have, you know, in the 2020 election cycle, we had a voter protection hotline answering questions that was open to all 20 million voters. It was not restricted to just Democrats. We recruited volunteer attorneys to ensure that we were monitoring issues that arose around the state of attempts of local registrars or local authorities who sought to restrict voters' ability to cast a ballot.
Which locales were those and actively happening in California?
You know, there's pockets of issues across the state. You know, California is large enough that there's a little bit of every part of the country in California. Places in the Central Valley, places in the North State. And, you know, occasionally you'll have momentary anomalies and challenges that need attention and focus of the registrar, even in places like the Bay Area or in Los Angeles. Orange County has been really an example of how to run a thorough, well-oiled machine of election administration.
We like our Neil Kelly very, very much. Community radio voters, we all really get that. We call him the gold standard.
He's well regarded, not only here in California, but in many ways around the country. I do think that Democrats year after year after year, whether it's, you know, same day registration or motor voter registration, now mailing a ballot to every voter and continuing to do so. You know, California Democrats have worked hard to make it easier for Californians to cast a ballot.
So you enumerated the districts that the DCCC is targeting in 2022. What's your role? How are you monitoring the California citizens redistricting process? Are you not expecting that there will be one congressional district that will be eliminated in the California congressional delegation? It's most likely.
Well, it's too soon to know. I mean, we won't have final census data until no earlier than September the 30th. Typically you get it April the 30th at the latest, and maybe even earlier. That is delayed really because of the, you know, global pandemic that we've been moving through. But the Independent Commission is planning to begin to take testimony in June or July. And then we'll receive final census data, you know, the latter part of September, the beginning of October, and they will then be in position to, you know, finalize their lines based upon census data and testimony in the latter part of the year or the beginning of 2022. You know, the process is designed to stand apart from partisans, including political parties. And therefore, we will, you know, continuing to monitor the commission's progress and take advantage of the opportunities that there are in new districts, and ensure that we're prepared to meet any challenges that we might see.
So it must be challenging, though, that you're, that candidates don't know where they're going to be located at that time. So it's very precious little time to actually map, literally and figuratively map out a campaign when those absolute finally decided on lines aren't known until that far into the 2022 season.
The anxiety for both incumbent members and candidates alike is raised every 10 years when this process takes place. Mm-hmm. And this year it's probably just a little bit higher than what you would normally see. So I don't envy the position they're all in.
So you were talking about building the whole electoral candidate farm team. And I wanted to know if part of your actually engaging in that is looking to building the city council special districts where candidates run to represent portions of cities on the council. Is that part of something you're wanting to continue after work you've done in other municipalities that you've been involved in Orange County?
Yeah, certainly the recruitment and the training of the next generation of public servants and grassroots leaders is an important part of our work. We've had some remarkable success. Obviously, everyone focuses on, the four seats, congressional seats, where you came up short. I would also direct folks' attention to two additional state Senate seats, a total of 60 assembly seats. The fact that Democrats won 53% of all the local government seats that were up for grabs in November of 2020. The fact that there were 468 Democrats that were elected to city councils, 468 women that were elected to city councils across the state, 2/3 of those were Democrats. And so there's been great progress for Democrats in stepping into local municipalities, local elections, local seats, whether they be mayor's seats or city council seats or school board seats or community college board seats or special districts. But it's not solely about recruiting and training the candidates themselves. It's also about supporting the campaign managers and organizers who actually run the campaigns and support those candidates. It's about supporting the grassroots leaders that run organizations that ultimately help those campaigns and support those candidates. You know, the Democrats in Orange County, led by our great chair, Otto Briceño, has done a phenomenal job at recruiting, endorsing, and supporting candidates at the local level. We just saw less than, a few weeks ago, the victory of Katrina Foley as Orange County supervisor, a seat that's not been held, by a Democrat in a long, long time, I think 120-something years. So I've been proud of the progress that we've been able to make there and know there's a lot more to do.
So in your role as a state Democratic Party chair, when in the campaign in 2020, during the pandemic, we could see how in the 48th that the then Orange County Board of Supervisor chair, Michelle Steele, it wasn't even subtle how she comported as though it was campaign content, the way in which she was very carefully available for managing the pandemic. And so I don't know if it's something that the state chair is watching how these candidates are using their offices effectively as campaigns, but not effectively as administrators. If that's on the county chair to communicate that to you, or how were you watching that? Because it was, as I said, it was not subtle. It was really clear what her board chair role was performing. And it wasn't to make us safer for the pandemic.
Well, I would say what Michelle Steele both did and continues to do today is in many ways an extension of the leader of the Republican Party, who sought to use the White House not solely to administer and keep Americans safe, but sought to further his own personal interest. And so it is not surprising to me that the Republican nominee and now the current Republican congressional member from the 48th would simply do the same.
So it's going to be very interesting from the local vantage point to watch then what kind of roles that the special elected Katrina Foley, former mayor of Costa Mesa with lots of local government experience, she's an attorney, what she does to sort of pry open what the county board of supervisors does, how it sets its priorities. So that local government opportunity is astounding, and how the accountability throughout a pandemic and as it's winding down at this point, to watch what this one, I don't know how long she'll be able to hold that office, but what she can do and perform in a very contrasting way in her role, following how Michelle Steele was performing her duties on the Board of Supervisors. Is that something you're looking at? And is there, as Harley Ruda, and you're prioritizing that race, are people talking to him about there's a whole different way he can take gloves off and deal with what kind of water that the incumbent Michelle Steele is carrying at this point?
Well, I don't think it will be that hard for the current supervisor, Katrina Foley, to contrast her governing style with that of the previous occupant of that seat, now congressional member, Michelle Steele, really because I know Katrina Foley is going to put the health and safety and the lives of Orange County residents ahead of all else. With regards to the 48th and that future race in 2022, you know, Michelle Steele is going to have to stand on her record and her votes as a current member of Congress, and I think the record will be pretty clear. With regards to, you know, a clear choice for voters in the 48th, the newly configured 48, whatever it might look like.
Right. That is the big question. I mean, people are already thinking that Orange County and Southern LA counties, congressional districts, that's where that district could easily be eliminated. So.
Well, it remains to be seen. It's, you know, I think there's the potential in Southeast Los Angeles for some changes to take place and potentially a ripple effect into other parts of the state, whether it's Orange County or into the Inland Empire. But it remains to be seen as to how the commission will ultimately confront this challenge, if in fact it's in front of them.
Well, I did interview the Huntington Beach commissioner and the Stockton commissioners, and they were already taking lots of testimony about that Long Beach definitely associates with LA. They really, there's a whole identity thing going on that they're, so they tipped their hand there. That's my hot scoop for listeners who didn't hear that interview about 2 weeks ago. So, well, I thank you for giving me extra time today with all that's going on. Thank you very much, Rusty Hicks, for being on Ask a Leader today.
It was great to be with you. I appreciated the opportunity.
My guest was California Democratic Party Chair Rusty Hicks, now running for re-election, the next four-year term for the California Democratic Party Chair. We're recording this on April 9th. The voting ends with all the delegates casting their votes by April 21st. We'll be right back with my second guest, Branda Lynn, with more Municipal Scoop with Irvine Watchdog. Welcome back to the show. My next guest is Branda Lynn in the second of our two-part interview. Today, we'll pick up the matter of the American Asphalt Company emissions in the north side of town, an environmental saga, and a case of Irvine watchdog in action, the Great Park, and the Irvine City Council. Branda Lynn, as I said last week, she is an Irvine native and co-founder of Irvine Watchdog, a volunteer-based website promoting transparency and accountability from our local government. Her professional life pursuits include paralegal work at several different Irvine law firms. She has served as an Irvine Community Service Commissioner, Irvine Children, Youth, Families Advisory Committee member, a driver for Irvine's Meals on Wheels program, an organizer of Families Forward of Food Drives, and is a board member of the National Women's Political Caucus, Orange County. Branda completed her Bachelor of Arts in Political Science and Musical Performance at UCI. She comes to us again today from her home in Irvine. We're recording this on April 9th. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Branda Lynn.
Thank you so much for welcoming me back.
Well, let's start with the ongoing saga of the American Asphalt Company's emissions in North Irvine. Mainly the abutters are the Portola Parkway, the Portola neighborhood, and they've been registering some foul odors, and this has brought a sort of a mobilizing of these neighborhoods to find out what the terms are for this industry to do business and to emit the various pollutants from their location. How have you been brought into this particular activity?
Sure. Well, I just want to clarify, this issue involves not only Portola Springs area, but Eastwood Village, Northwood, as well as Orchard Hills. So it's really North Irvine, as well as Northeast Irvine. And how Watchdog got involved was actually their group reached out to us. The residents in North Irvine have been battling this public health issue for over 2 years now. And they've started a group called Stop Toxic Asphalt Pollutants. And it's led by Leslie Tan and Kevin Lien, along with Kim Conti of Non-Toxic Neighborhoods. And they've really taken the lead in advocating for a public study session to see what toxins, if any, are that they're being exposed to. And that's been their main number one request of our city council since day one.
Give us a dateline again, please, Branda, if you will.
Sure. So the Stop Toxic Asphalt Pollutants group formed just in the last year, but their two leaders, Leslie Tan and Kevin Lien, had been submitting letters, complaints for 2 years now. And they had, since November of 2020, they've been asking for an Irvine City Council initiated public study session. And that's just been their number one request.
So the constituents wanted to put it on the radar of the council, having the council be accountable for responding to what may not be a permitted level of emissions, correct?
Correct. And, you know, the primary responsibility lies with Southern California Air Quality Management District. They're also known as AQMD. And the city does not have the power to, you know, shut down the asphalt plant, but they can take a lead in advocating for Irvine residents and hold a city council initiated public study session. And they just haven't been able to do that. And they haven't done that yet. One of our council members did bring forth a memo a couple meetings ago asking for council support in placing this public study session on the agenda, but it did not receive a second. And that kind of leads into the agenda setting policy, which was just put in place with this new city council earlier this year.
Right at the swearing in, it was put in place in December. It was continued.
Correct. And for background, that agenda setting policy was brought forth by Mayor Christina Shea in 2019, and it was in place for 1 year, but it was supposed to sunset in November 2020. However, with the new city council, Mayor Farah Khan and Councilmember Anthony Kuo placed it on the agenda, and it did pass 4-1, making it permanent now. And the agenda setting policy requires that two council members approve an item to be placed on the agenda, or the mayor can put it on herself.
So does Irvine Watchdog have a kind of a group that's working on overcoming that codified rule on the city council that mutes what one council member sees the importance in putting on the agenda.
Yes, we have reported on it extensively. There were opinion articles as well, submitted and published. We have made public comments. The League of Women Voters even got involved, stating their opposition to the policy, yet it still passed. And it will take another city council to reverse this decision. At the core of it, you know, it really does take away a large percentage of voices in our city. There are three big issues, probably the three largest issues for our residents right now that we haven't been able to put on the agenda because of this policy. There's been one council member who has brought forth a request to get the All-American Asphalt Public Study Session on the agenda, the Great Park Advisory Committee issue on the agenda, which we'll get to later, as well as the Veterans Cemetery issue. And, you know, whether you are in support of an issue or not, I think there's so much value in hearing a robust discussion on the pros and cons and giving the public an opportunity to weigh in and to hear this discussion publicly. But unfortunately, we just have not been able to hear or hold a public hearing on these issues.
It begs the question, Brandilyn, is it a policy matter or is it a personality dynamic problem going on right now?
That's a very good question. And some have speculated one or the other that, you know, perhaps it's a personality issue. It's, you know, there are some council members who just gravitate towards each other, feel comfortable working with each other. And some who may perhaps they don't feel as comfortable working with certain council members. We really don't know. This is just speculation. But it does seem from what we've seen from you know, we've been watching every single council meeting since this new council has been sworn in. There seems to be a new majority, and it is beyond, you know, partisan lines. And there is one council member who again and again has been silenced. So
who's that? Is it the one who's not there at the panel, the one who's doing this remotely?
Yeah, it's council member Larry Agron. He is the one who brought forth a request for the public study session on behalf of the Stop Toxic Asphalt Pollutants group and didn't receive a second. He did recently at the Great Park board meeting request that the Great Park Advisory Committee be placed on the agenda as well on behalf of the Great Park residents who've been wanting a voice in the decision-making process there. And I do not believe it has received a second as of yet. And then the third issue, the Veteran Cemetery, which I think everybody has known that this issue is very important to Councilmember Larry Agron, and he ran on this. So I'm sure he feels somewhat of an obligation to stand by his promises to his voters, to his supporters in pursuing and making sure the Veteran Cemetery gets built. And we do have a great opportunity right now. Senators Dave Mann and Tom Umberg did provide a letter, a very well-written letter, I might add, that outlines the fact that they did earmark money from the state. And, you know, our city just needs to decide on a location.
So we're not done yet with the American Asphalt Company that UCI has been brought on with the chemistry department that deals with atmospheric loads of pollutants and things like that. So they are available as sort of technical experts. So there's a lot that can be done to address what the North Irvine residents are dealing with. I mean, it's not known yet the extent to which this is a public health hazard, but you mentioned about a matter of agendizing this. So what does the watchdog group do to continue advancing the public health part for the northern part of the city?
Well, we've just reported on what has transpired and what the facts were, which neighborhoods were affected, how many complaints. It was just a news article. We did receive opinion articles from the STAP group, which the Stop Toxic Asphalt Pollutants group, I'll refer to them as STAP just for short. We received a couple of opinions, which we published. But other than informing residents and giving them a platform to share information that they've obtained, the concerns that they have, we really haven't done much. Though the STAP group themselves have been protesting at the model homes in Eastwood Village. They have come up with lawn signs that they've put out throughout the neighborhood. And before the election, they held a protest in their neighborhood on, I believe, was it Jeffrey and Irvine Boulevard in that area, just to inform people of the issue and the concerns that they had.
Okay. So anything in addition you'd like to bring listeners in on for what needs to happen next?
I think the request has remained the same. I think the public deserves to hear the reports from UCI, the UCI volunteer advisors that they have that went out and collected air samples with canisters in various areas. The city of Irvine also hired a consultant, Nino and Moore, to do their own studies. However, according to what I've received from the staff group, they went out on days collecting air samples when the rubber crumb system was not in operation.
Okay. Because I know, and I did a little bit of background work on this, and that is what one of the staff members at UCI was mentioning, is that it's a matter of timing, but that there could be some significant elevated levels, elevated from what they're permitted. So this is a concern. So we'll just keep that in front of listeners for the time being. So my guest, if you just joined us, is Branda Lynn, co-founder of Irvine Watchdog, holding elected and appointed Irvine municipal officials accountable. We're recording this on April 9th. Let's move now to the Great Park. Once a marine station, then a park, now a private sports facility, essentially, that's sort of an amenity serving the Five Point community's homes. But let's talk about the role that the abutting landowners have in the outcomes and what you're finding following the money in the improvements that are being made, and what would this advisory group that Larry Agron is trying to get agendized, what would the purpose of that advisory group be in what the park, the Great Park rollout is becoming?
Well, originally, the Orange County Great Park Board was set up as a 9-member executive board. We had members of the city council, our 5 city council members, as well as 4 at-large members that control the operations.
From around the county.
Correct, from around the county. And that all changed when the majority flipped in 2012. One of the first things that happened after that election was they removed the 4 at-large committee members. And so we have the same 5 council members that are elected who now also make all the decisions for the Great Park Board. What recently happened was the Voice of OC came out with a series of 3 articles highlighting this special property tax that Great Park neighborhood residents are required to pay, which increases 2% annually for the next 40 years. And it's something that they were apparently, a lot of them are stating that they weren't aware of. However, it was disclosed in the builder assessment and tax disclosure form. And so now Great Park residents have come to realize that a lot of their money is being used perhaps to help build some of the amenities in the Great Park. They'd like a voice. And that's when residents in the Great Park decided to mobilize and request that they have an opportunity to weigh in on the decisions impacting their neighborhood and the Great Park.
So not agendizing this item, what is that doing with the accountability for that assessment?
Well, I don't know if there's anything at this point that could be done about the special tax that was decided years ago. And it is something that was disclosed in their contracts, so they are bound to. However, they can have a greater voice in the decision-making process, which is what they're seeking. So by placing this item on the agenda, it would give the public an opportunity to see what the benefits would be to have, ultimately, voices outside of the 5 city council members that we have currently on the Great Park Board. Because again, originally, it was set up as a committee just making decisions on behalf of the entire Orange County Great Park. And so having those at-large members, it would benefit in terms of providing additional perspectives, interests, ideas, and some checks and balances, because as we know, the developer for the Great Park is one of the largest campaign contributors in Irvine politics. So just to provide some checks and balances, I think it'd be great to have the at-large members placed again. And if not, at least an advisory committee made up of perhaps at least 1 or 2 Great Park neighborhood residents that would be able to see the decisions that are being brought forward, the ideas, the development plans, and be able to not only relay it back to their neighborhood residents, who it's going to impact most directly, but also have a say, especially given the fact that they do have this special tax that they have to pay, which goes back into a lot of the development in the Great Park.
So there's a tension in the construct of what is the Great Park. When you look at it from an urbanist standpoint, the intention originally was it would be a regional amenity, and the move by the city council in the fall of 2012 to make it a board composed strictly of the city council, it redefined what kind of an amenity the Great Park was going to be operating as and was going to be managed. So this is that kind of regional versus municipal kind of title, something you're using as a discussion point.
I think the Great Park residents, not so much, especially because they feel they are monetarily obligated now to support a lot of the development in the Great Park with a special tax. So they just want a voice and a say in what goes in. For instance, the water polo facility, is that an amenity that they will be able to use as Great Park residents, or is there a benefit to them? Perhaps they can have a lower cost for entrance, or will there be a public pool for us to use, or will it strictly be for swim teams that come into the area and come to the facility just for their tournament? So, you know, having a voice, I think, is something we'd all want to increase, especially from those who are supporting the development of the Great Park with the special tax.
Again, had Irvine Watchdog been around over 10 years ago, where we would have the benefit of amplifying what was in the works for tilting this amenity toward a privatization, we would be in a whole different situation right now. So we talked about this. We said, this is going to be a pay-to-play a park. But we were told, we were put on notice. So how do listeners bring to bear on agendizing a Great Park Advisory Group to come before the city council?
I think one great way is to email the council members and reach out and share how you feel about the importance of having an advisory committee, having some representation from the residents who live in the Great Park neighborhoods. Another way is through public comments. There have been a lot more public comments in the last few meetings regarding this issue, but keep at it. We want to pressure our council to know this is important to us, if it is important to you, and to really be heard in that way.
So it's a tough sell if it's beyond the Great Park residents that you're talking about to get people to get skin in that game. But the Great Park Advisory Group could serve a lot of more broad municipal needs, could it not?
I believe so. And, you know, I think the name of the game is public benefits. What can we do for Irvine residents? The Cultural Terrace, it's an area that was, you know, designated for cultural amenities. And what's happening to that? You know, there was a lot of concern about the shift and even calling it the Cultural Terrace. Somebody mentioned once that it was no longer being called the Cultural Terrace. And what we've been seeing in the Great Park are original plans constantly shifting. And I would argue that it kind of coincides with what's the shift that we've been seeing in terms of the money in politics in Irvine. I mentioned that Great Park Board had 4 at-large seats that were removed once the majority shifted right after. That was one of the first things that happened. So I don't think it was coincidental. And again, knowing that the developer of the Great Park is one of the largest campaign contributors in our local races says a lot. There's a lot of money to be had. However, our city council, if they would advocate on our behalf, try to fight for public benefits that can benefit future generations, current residents, that's what really we'd be hoping for. And I think that's where you find the best collaborative efforts to come up with the best plans to move forward for our city. There's a public-private partnership with the developer of the Great Park, and having the developer come with their plans and their ideas, and then having our city council come and bring forth ideas on behalf of residents and what we can provide would be, I think, the best, that would be the ideal. And I believe what we've been seeing is more developer-led, developer-dictated plans, and our city council being more responsive to that.
So I'm concerned, and I'm on a flag here, is that there are gestures that a council can offer its constituents, fly this multicolored LGBTQ flag and do various things. But I'm looking at, is there a kind of a holding on to a privileged kind of power to sort of mediate the resources in a really tight circle and not bring in a municipal vision that got us the Great Park in the beginning? That was vision, and it was multi-level kind of public participation, but it looks, do you not see in your work in Irvine Watchdog a contraction of leadership in the kind of city vision?
If you look at the history of how we got to where we are today, yes, absolutely. Being an Irvine native and being a product of this city and the wonderful amenities that it provides, you know, I think of Heritage Park a lot because that was something that our city council fought for. And it has equipment and classes and amenities that you can't find even throughout the county. And that was a vision that our city council had back in the 70s. I think about Bomber Canyon. It took our city council then 3 years of negotiating with the developer to secure and to protect that land. You know, if we look to our recent city councils and we ask ourselves, what have they done on our behalf for the public benefit? I feel like that word is so important. Those two words are so important, public benefit. And every city council should be asking themselves, what can we do on behalf of this city? You know, our city has grown exponentially. And yet we still have the same public benefits that I had as a child, the same number of public libraries, even though those are county jurisdiction. Certainly our city council can advocate on our behalf, you know, lobby the assembly members, lobby the Orange County Board of Supervisors, and really get something going for the residents. But what we've been seeing is an imbalance in the growth. We've been seeing a lot of homes being built. But what about the public benefits for the community and for its residents? And that's something I think we should be asking our city council members and future candidates going forward. Is there a commitment? Is there a commitment to providing public community benefits on our behalf and advocating for our needs and making sure the growth is balanced and the infrastructure is balanced as we head into building out our city?
So the very last question, Branda, Lynn, is Irvine Watchdog looking at circumstances to force a special district for each council member to run from?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I don't know if you saw the recent supplemental agenda for the city council, but there's a closed session item, and the city did receive a letter from an attorney who is known throughout the state. I believe he's Malibu based, and he has sued cities, forcing them to go to districts or to form districts.
Right. I've heard of him.
But yes. And we just received a letter from him, and there is a closed session item at this Tuesday's city council meeting. So I would encourage the public, if you're listening to this, submit a public comment if you are in support of district elections. Our city is almost 290,000 residents, and we are still at large. And so for our candidates, it's very difficult. It's nearly impossible to meet and knock on all the doors. You need to fundraise a lot of money. One mailer alone, even if it's targeted, costs approximately $20,000 to $30,000.
At least. I think it's even more than that. Over $30,000. Yes.
So, you know, that would really help in terms of candidates being able to reach all the voters, and they wouldn't have to fundraise as much money. And I think it would benefit our city. I do think it would be helpful to have more city council members given the size of our city and where we're headed, but this would be a good first step in having districts, and we'll see what comes of it.
Okay, so it's the Malibu attorney that's initiated this, and Irvine Watchdog is going to look and see how this is going to take form, and their Irvine Watchdog may have some bearing. It's not a partisan issue, but this is right in the area in which you're operating?
this is something that Urban Watchdog, a lot of its volunteers have asked for and has advocated for. This was one of the questions that was asked at our candidates forum before the 2020 election. So this is something we have been following. And I know there were efforts before by residents to ask for districts, but I think with this letter coming from this attorney now, it'll really pressure the council, because my understanding is he hasn't lost a case.
Once you're served, you're served. And I think, isn't it, there has to be a sort of a demonstration of an underrepresented demographic that forces this creation.
Correct. And I didn't read the details of the letter. It is provided on the city's website. If you go to this upcoming city council meeting's agenda, you'll see it as an attachment. And just to clarify, it wasn't a letter pressing litigation, but it was a request for Irvine to move to district elections. And if not, it did have some language at the end, I believe, stating that otherwise a suit may follow.
So, and I did interview a batch of Irvine City Council candidates last September, and that was one of my sort of lightning round questions. And the preponderance of them supported it, but not everybody. And so, Brandilyn, how can, again, folks follow you closely and get in touch with you?
Well, you can follow us, Irvine Watchdog Volunteers, by going to irvinewatchdog.org and subscribing to our website and our articles. There are lots of sources of information on there, and you can also get involved. We'd love to have more volunteers, whether it's one article or several. If you'd like to get involved in watching a city council meeting or a committee or a commission meeting as well, I'd really like to encourage all the listeners to really commit to watching at least one city council meeting this year, just to become familiar with our council members and the process. And, you know, if there's an issue that you care about, to use your voice and submit a public comment or an email, and feel free to reach out to our council members. They work for us. So don't be afraid to ask them the tough questions. And the more eyes on our local government, the better. Our city, we're the number one master plan community, and we have good fiscal health for years. We're top in safety, and we're celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. So there will be many activities, I'm sure, to come through our city. And I just really encourage everyone to get involved and help create, you know, a wonderful community that Irvine has been known for and has now. And these are really exciting times. I think it's easier now than ever before to get involved, to submit a public comment. You don't have to drive through rush hour traffic to get to City Hall to wait for your turn to make a public comment. You can just submit it from your home. And so I just really encourage everybody to stay connected, follow Irvine Watchdog, and, you know, together, let's really help shape the future of our city.
So that I know how it works, Brenda, people, can they live attend the meeting, or is it the emails that they've sent?
You can watch live on ICTV.
You can watch, but how do they, can they comment? Can they comment live too now?
There's, yes, via Zoom. And
they can get invited into the Zoom room. Okay.
So your video won't show, but when it's your turn, they will ask you to unmute your mic.
Your mic is what appears at the meeting. And how many minutes does each person have to speak to each agenda item?
3 minutes.
And the public comment period is also 3 minutes. They can comment both in the general period as well as each agenda item.
Correct. The general period, yes.
Well, I want to thank you for this extra time, the second round of what Irvine Watchdog's doing, and for all of your service. Brandilyn, thank you so much for coming back to Ask a Leader.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest was Brandilyn, co-founder of Irvine Watchdog, holding officials accountable here in Irvine, and we're recording this on April 9th. Well, that's my wrap. For next week's show, Jamie Benal brings his book, 20 Million Angry Men, The Case of Including Convicted Felons in Our Jury System. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.